and welcome to Between the Margins at CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Michelle Boyce.
I'm Bailey Lamont.
And we have a great show for you today. There is a kerfuffle happening at Queen's Park, and it's the Conservatives have managed to squeak this one through on us, and you know, it's past second reading, and nobody even thought twice about it because it actually doesn't show in the bill what it means.
No.
And, you know, and then thanks to a couple of amazing advocates, one in Ottawa and one in Toronto, that that have taken up the mantle on this, and this is Bill 88 and the privatization of welfare for 16, 17-year-olds.
Actually, it'd be 16 to possibly 24.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this is Jane on the phone, and Jane is a paralegal, an advocate, and an agitator for many, many years in Ottawa. How are you doing, Jane?
Not bad, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this, because it's very troubling. If it goes through, I think we're going to have even more problems with our child welfare system than we currently have.
We are going to have a lot more problems with it, in my opinion, and I think you share that with me.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about what we have right now. And to introduce that, we've got a short little clip here put out by the Justice for Youth Committee.
Mm-hmm. What's Ontario Works? Also known as welfare or assistance. It's money to help pay for your day-to-day needs such as rent, food, clothing, and prescription drugs. There are rules about who can get OW assistance and what someone must do to keep getting it. If you're 16 or 17, you can get welfare only under special circumstances. You may have to show OW that your parents do not let you live at home, or that it is not safe or not healthy for you to live at home. Any time that you miss school, you must have a justified reason or OW might end. If you're suspended or expelled, you may be cut off from OW. You can rent your own apartment. When you move into a new place, OW can help you cover the cost of extra items. It's against the law for a landlord to refuse to rent an apartment to you because you're 16 or 17 years old, or because you are on OW. To apply, contact your local Ontario Works office. Bring any ID that you have and proof that you are enrolled in a school or a training program.
So that kind of gives you an idea a little bit about the system that we're on right now. And So... you know, right now, a youth runs into problems at home that's 16 or 17 years old. What do they do?
Well, they apply to Ontario Works, and they need to have a reason to be leaving home at that early age. And even if that bill goes through, that's not going to change. They're not going to privatize welfare and then have no criteria. At 16, 17, they'll probably have the same criteria. If the home is suitable and the parents are willing, then there's not an entitlement. But they don't have to prove it to an nth degree. They just have to report what unsuitable conditions exist in the home, and that makes them eligible for the assistance. But if they come in and say, oh, you know, I just don't feel like living at home anymore, you know, like school's drag and I want to, you know, just go and do my thing.
Then we send them back home and say.
Yeah, because they're too young. They're too young to just go and take such a serious step without any good reason. But there's many, many reasons that the home might be unsuitable or unsafe. If they're directly abused or if they're neglected. You know, if their basic needs aren't met, that sort of thing. And then once they're applying, there is criteria that they continue school, which I don't think is unreasonable. But there are variations. There are accommodations made if there's disabilities or other issues that are preventing them from attending school. They can still receive assistance as long as they're receiving attention for those difficulties. Also reasonable. If it's done, you know, in a positive manner, there's nothing unnatural or unfair about having a little bit of criteria.
So we're basically talking about kids here that you know, they're in an abusive situation at home or untenable situation at home, that, because it doesn't have to be abuse, physical or emotional. It could be that there's many situations mm-hmm. where the parents just aren't able or aren't offering proper care.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For example, if they're very ill. I know one woman who was dying of cancer, and in the last 2 years, she was not able to attend to her children very well. I mean, it could be something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be worse. It's something, bad intentions on the part of the parent.
So these kids have a place to go, and, you know, the kids that we work with here in London, the same as you there, that they can get an apartment, they can, you know, set up their life. They have, you know, not a lot of money.
No.
Like, OW gives them $225 a month for personal needs. You know, so these kids aren't rich.
No, absolutely not. No. But there are a lot of support programs in Ottawa that supplement that. There's soup kitchens and drop-in centers for youth. And they have food there, and they have counselors. They actually have what we call in Ottawa case management, which means that drop-in center staff will take a specific interest in the kids that are dropping in there. I mean, it's not a forced thing; it's a voluntary process. But they're willing to provide support, like emotional support, for their issues. As well as advocacy around situations where they need resources. They need additional resources. For example, it could be counseling, it could be drug addiction programs, or any number of physical needs, dental needs, whatever the case might be. These people are hooked in to all of that process, and unfortunately, agencies have a better chance of getting resources too than the individual does. That's not just for youth, that's any age, right? So that's a really useful way to manage things. In Ottawa, this process was introduced as a result of the homeless action strikes that were in 2003 and 2004. There was a mayor's task force set up in response to that. It was mostly homeless youth that were managing those protests. And prior to that, they had drop-in centers, but they didn't get involved. Staff didn't get involved. And they had serious problems with things as simple as ID. When Children's Aid puts them out on the street at 16, they don't even give them ID. That's the standard treatment. That's the systemic, long-standing practice. They put them out with no ID. So no health card, no SIM card, no nothing. And then they're not eligible for OW either, because OW has a rule: if you're eligible for financial assistance from anywhere else, you're not entitled to assistance under OW. So a lot of these street kids had huge barriers to stability. And one of the main barriers is this ID business, because with no income, it was very difficult for them to go through the process, because there's fees, and then you have to get the mail to you, and they're homeless, and et cetera, et cetera. Anyways, that was one of the tasks that these drop-in centers took over when they started doing case management. And they would also assist them in getting their finances set up, their housing set up, and whatever other resources. And it was very, very effective. We had hundreds, like from Harris, Mike Harris days, there was probably thousands of kids homeless all over the place. And within a few months after they started instituting their recommendations from the task force, the kids were off the street into various programs and starting to, you know, stabilize and function.
Wonderful. I mean, that's what we find with the kids that we serve, is that once we get involved, then within a couple of months, we take them from a homelessness situation into a housed situation.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a lot of work. And I mean, that ID piece is probably the biggest crucial piece of the whole thing. Because without a birth certificate, they can't get service.
Yeah, that's right.
And most of these kids don't even know the information that they need to fill out a birth certificate application.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Where it is and the fees for it. And then it has to be mailed somewhere. You know, so without assistance, that's impossible to do.
So let's talk about this, this Bill 88 that, you know, is a bunch of legal mumbo-jumbo that, you know, as you even pointed out when I was talking to you earlier, the founder of the bill, this Rod Jackson, conservative dude obviously, you know, doesn't give a care. But this dude doesn't even mention Children's Aid in all of his speeches about this bill.
Because I believe that he's done that because they don't have credibility at this time. There's been so much protesting and exposing of what they're doing and pressure on the government to bring accountability and all that sort of thing. I think he didn't dare say Children's Aid because he was trying to slide that through as a humanitarian response to young kids, keep them off the street and keep them out of jails. But nothing could be further from the truth, because 80% of the kids on the street and 80% of those in jail are from the Children's Aid process. So I don't think we want to, you know, up the percentages, with transferring responsibility for all 16 and older. It's a little bit deceiving when it's only a one-page bill, and it looks at first glance to be only talking about 16 and 17-year-olds. But if you read the existing Child and Family Services Act, there's a section in there that says that any youth that was entitled to benefits at 16 and 17 is entitled to benefits after or 18 and older. And currently, if you were never in Children's Aid before 16, you're not eligible after. But this Bill 88 would make you eligible, and every child eligible at 16 to 18. So if you left home at 18, you would still be eligible for 18 and over, because you were eligible at 16 and 17, but even if you didn't apply for it, you're still eligible for it. I hope that's not too confusing, because it kind of looped back with
To put it in plain terms, you know, they put provisions in place in the Act so that if you're receiving services, say you're a disabled person that can't take care of yourself and you need trustee services for life, then you know, the Act stipulates that you can still get those services.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that it's abused.
Well, yes. And in this case, because they've made basically all youth, and there's no cutoff age, it's 16 and then to 18, so 16 to 18 and 18 and older. They actually just say and older. So it doesn't even have a cutoff date. We're assuming that it can't be much past 24, because then you wouldn't be youth anymore. And the bill, Child and Family Services Act, is definitely encompassing resources and supports for youth, right? So they couldn't go past 24, I don't believe. But
I don't know. The Catholic Church says 35 is youth. So.
Oh, my God. Oh. Okay, well, I guess they could stretch it. But usually I think the charter defines youth as up to 24. You know, it writes on the basis of age.
Yeah.
I believe it's 24. So that's why we're saying we're for sure 21, because CAS very consistently tries to keep kids in care till 21 in some cases. But there is entitlement even after 21, because there's no cutoff date.
So we're putting these two concepts together, and I mean, the listeners out there are probably at this point in time, you know, because the general population tends to think that the children aid is a good thing.
Well, I think that they're losing ground in that regard. They've been trying desperately to regain their public support and their image, but I think it's too tarnished now. And with this Jeffrey Baldwin inquest coming on, or it's in process, I think that's pretty much gonna, you know, upset their apple cart for good. I don't see them regaining. There's thousands and thousands of people in this movement, eh? This Children's Aid Reform movement through the social media and so on. And I mean, it's gone beyond that. The connections were made through the social media, but there's protesting and one-on-one support and all kinds of things that have evolved from those contacts. And a lot of stuff has solidified, you know, into groups and it's amazing. I've never seen anything so vast. In terms of you know, public organization is this, and I know their power is tremendous, so you do need a vast, you know, a vast
well, that's always
campaign.
Been their point, yeah. Right, is yeah. They've always controlled the messaging, they've always silenced their advocates,
yeah. Yeah.
And
absolutely,
and then they have court orders that seal yeah. everything and put it in a nice, neat little package, and the only ones that mm-hmm. are allowed to talk about the Children's Aid Society are the Children's Aid Society.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I think, like I say, I think it's gotten out of control on them. They just can't seem to keep the lid on the Facebook. There's people in there, you can see that there's, you know, what we call trolls, right? At work trying to, you know, cause dissension and, you know, like, for example, There's a group of them on there trying to insist that it's an adverse thing for people to provide one-on-one support to each other. Like, this is destroy, and protests are, you know, dirty things, and they're just not, you know, worthy of being part of this movement. They're destroying the movement, blah, 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 as if. You know, these two factors are the cornerstone of this movement. That's what built this movement. And they say that, no, you just need to, you know, lobby with your politicians, you know, and just be kind of low-key and sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bailey, yeah, no. Bailey, my co-host here, is one of the loudest protesters.
I was actually wanting to ask you, because you mentioned homeless action strikes, and I mean,
yes.
Just from looking at kind of the wording of how all of this is being put together, It's definitely done in a way where, I mean, we even have trouble kind of understanding what they're trying to do with this bill.
Yeah.
And I mean, I feel like the youth who are going to be affected by this bill, I mean, I'm wondering if they're even going to be able to have any kind of understanding of what this means for them or what their rights are in these situations, you know, because...
Well,
it's like you said, everybody.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to say, because like you
yeah,
said
ahead,
that everybody kind of, you know, not a lot of people know about this, and it's kind of just going through without any trouble, and yeah, so.
So the youth are
going. The sad part about it is that under the Children's Aid process, the children don't have any rights because it's not a government process. Our rights are in the charter. That only applies to government. Doesn't apply to the Children's Aid. They're not even a crown organization or something like that where they sort of loosely apply, you know, charter rights to. They don't apply to them, period.
Wow.
So, yeah, so, and on top of that, this one, I just learned this one a couple of weeks ago. I always think I know it all now. And then something else comes up. When we were doing the research for this bill, we came across a section of the Child and Family Services Act that says the court cannot order the Children's Aid to provide services or resources.
So this
I'll just follow you through a child, say, at 16. They've never been in care before. This is under the new bill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because under the existing legislation, any child that was in Children's Aid before 16 has to stay with Children's Aid till 18. But under the new bill at 16, they say they weren't with Children's Aid, and now they're going to, you know, go out on their own for whatever reason. They try to go to Ontario Works. Ontario Works is going to say, no, you no longer have eligibility for Ontario Works because Children's Aid is now providing it. So you need to go over there and apply for it. So if you go over there and apply for it and they have some kind of budget restraint and they say, oh, well, you know, too bad we're only doing 10 applications today. And they send you away. There's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing you can do about it because there's no oversight. With the ombudsman or that sort of thing, there's no requirement that they be fair and reasonable. That's been a long-standing. There's lots of legal precedent, and there's actual provision requiring government services to be offered in a fair, reasonable way, and then we have rights attached to that as well, and blah blah blah. But all of that is completely null and void when it comes to the application of Child and Family Services Act because this is a private organization. So, because the reason I know this is because this is already what's happening to the kids that are already in their jurisdiction. That's, we found all over the street kids like that. They were technically entitled to Children's Aid, but Children's Aid wasn't responding. We tried to advocate, the workers wouldn't even call back.
Oh.
They didn't know us. They didn't know us or anything. That was my first, introduction to what was going on with Children's Aid. And there wasn't anything personal. They weren't calling me back. It was just their standard routine. So a 16-year-old kid sitting on the street with no income, no family, no ID, thanks to their process. And I attempted to get this ID for this one kid. And when we went to Health Canada, the clerk said, I said, why are they not giving them their health card when they leave? And he says, I don't know. He said, I've worked here for 10 years and they've been doing it the whole time I'm here. He says, they say that they want them to get it in their own address.
And yet they have no, a lot of the time they have no, they don't have the information they need to be able to take these steps.
No, for sure.
Well, fortunately,
for sure,
Service Ontario with health cards is awesome with these kids.
Yes.
You know, I've had great success with the people at Service Ontario with health cards.
Yes.
You know, just simply the kid's picture's on file. They look at the kid, they look at the picture, say, yep, that's you. And
right
then they reissue a new address and a new health card right there on the spot. So, but you need a birth certificate. A health card doesn't help. You need a birth certificate to get services
from OW. One way you can do it, I swore an affidavit for this kid because I'd known him for a couple of years and they let me do that. And then that got him started. That was his first ID. And that got him started. You know, you have to have one before you get the other ones, right? Except I think for the birth certificate, you don't need anything.
No.
But in Ottawa, they have a good, they have one health community health center that actually will do the whole process for them. They'll get the birth certificate, the SIN card and the health card and keep it there for them. And then they come pick it up.
That's
wonderful. Great. Yeah. But initially, like back in the day, there was nothing. But now the drop-in centers will assist, and then this for the younger kids, and then for older people, they have it at the community center.
Unfortunately, so many communities in Ontario and across Canada are still back in the day.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's bad. But anyways, I hope we've done enough damage to this campaign, or whatever you call it, their move to privatize welfare. I think it was nicely just slipping by everyone's attention. And Pam and I just haphazardly were introduced to the issue. Actually, what we were doing is responding to a social media post that said, Bill 88, a bill to help keep kids off the street and out of jail. Okay, so that got my attention. It's like, what? You know, like, what could this be? and then I look at it, and right away when you look at it, you know for sure it's privatization for 16 and 17. You know for sure. Okay, then when we looked into it a little deeper, it goes beyond because it loops back from the existing legislation. So they're still entitled after 18 with that. So anyway, it's a little, like, sleight of hand, you know, those little cups they put on the table and they put a ball underneath and then they move them all around?
Yeah.
That's what it's like. And so, you know, it, and I talked to, I forget her name, but I talked to the woman from CUPE who's supposedly on this committee with Bill 88, and she says, oh, well, we're not too concerned about it because it's only for 16, 17-year-olds. It's not going to make that much difference with layoffs and stuff. You know, and I was like, no, it's potentially up to 24.
And those 16 and 17-year-olds are the most vulnerable.
Oh, God, yeah.
Once you hit 18, you have all kinds of rights, and you have all kinds of ability to advocate for yourself. But those 16 and 17-year-olds, and even 14, 15-year-olds are even worse. But that's a total another story altogether. But once you hit 16, you have certain rights. You can check yourself into school. You can control your own schooling. Healthcare, you, at any age in Ontario, you can, if you understand, you can, so a 12-year-old or 10-year-old can manage their own healthcare. So that's wonderful. But, you know, you run into these situations. I mean, hypothetical, not so hypothetical scenario that, you know, you have a religious-based family that is against birth control.
Yeah.
And you have a child who needs a girl that needs birth control for medical reasons to regulate her period. She's having trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the family won't allow her to have that birth control. She goes out, she consents to her own health care, she gets her own birth control, because you can do that at 14, and her parents kick her out on the street.
Yeah.
You know?
They can't legally do that at 14. There's repercussions.
There are repercussions at 14, but at 16 they can.
Yes, absolutely.
And then we have someone at the street that needs the OW system to work.
Actually, they can do something worse than kick them out on the street at 14. They can kick them into CAS.
There is that, too. Yeah. So Jane, we're going to be back after these messages talking more about this welfare privatization, children's aid, and the rest of the gamut with you. We'll be right back.
Okay, thanks.
We are all in this together.
And we're back with Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after on CHRW 94.9 FM. And I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Bailey Lamon.
And I've got Jane Scarf on the phone, who is, 30 years agitating and advocating for youth there in Ottawa, Jane?
Oh, yeah. Yep, pretty much.
Excellent.
Yep. So tell us some of the work that you've done through the years.
Well, I think the biggest accomplishment was the organizing those homeless strikes in the Harris days, because Ottawa was completely barbaric in terms of how they were responding to homeless issue. And they were using what I call an enforcement model, you know, kick them in the ass and then that'll make them not want to be homeless. It's like ridiculous.
They still do a lot of that today.
Yeah, well, in Ottawa, they made quite a revolutionary change towards a supportive model, and the supportive model actually costs one-third to implement of the cost, and it's effective. The enforcement model isn't effective, but it costs three-quarters more, and that's because, or two-thirds more, it's because you're using police and jails and court and hospitals, like psychiatric hospitals, involuntary confinement, as a way of trying to address these problems. And it doesn't work. It's a revolving door. Like it's not stabilizing the individual. And in fact, it's creating more trauma and more, you know, difficulties for them. And there was some studies done in several major cities in North America, and they determined that it's way cheaper to provide support towards the stabilization.
Well, it's always more effective to, you know, housing first model, get people into housing, mm-hmm. get them into, you know, a reasonable stream of financial support than it is to institutionalize anybody.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, we've proven that time in and time out again. And I always say on this show, whenever I'm talking about homelessness and, you know, somebody who is cut the OW, cut the support, just, you know, mm-hmm. cut them off. And I'm like, where do you think they go when you cut them off? Like, do you think they just vanish and they're no longer seen, heard, or cost you any money anymore?
Yeah. I told you that story about our former mayor there.
Well, saying, tell us again.
Okay. Larry O'Brien was our former mayor, and very hardcore right-wing, you know, enforcement model. And during the election, the Sun editor asked him what he plans to do with the homeless when he gets in. And he says, well, I visited the carp dump there recently, and they have a really good method of getting rid of the pigeons. And he said they have a scarecrow and a fake gun, and the fake gun goes off every 15 minutes. And that's not even enough. He said once a week or so they have to go out and actually shoot one of the birds, and then there's nothing like the sound of that dead body hitting the pavement to scare the other birds. And the editor asked him, well, what does that have to do with what you're planning to do with the homeless? And he says, well, they need enforcement. They need enforcement. We have to go out there and arrest them, and arrest them very visibly so the others will see. And that may take some time, but that's what's going to work. So scare them into being not homeless. And then, he made another comment at one of the debates. He said, In the past 6 years, the incumbent mayor and the fake homeless person, which she's referring to me, couldn't figure out what to do with the problem of the homeless people under the Terry Fox Bridge, which is downtown. It's actually an underpass, but everybody calls it a bridge. But kids sleep under there for, you know, to get out of the elements. And he said, you know, they couldn't figure out what to do with it. But he's just been down there one or two times, and he knows what to do with it. He says the one side where there's a slope where they all sleep, just put a big fence across there. And on the other side where they sleep, it's the capital city, so he could put information kiosks let vendors come down there and set up and stuff like that. And then he, you know, brushes his hands together, then problem solved. And I repeated that story at a drop-in center about a week later, and there was a woman there who was notably developmentally delayed. And when I finished the story, she was listening to me intently, and at the end she goes, but where will homeless people go? That's supposed to be our leader saying that. You know, Jesus. And anyway, that's but he didn't. One thing I'm really proud of the support industry in Ottawa for having resisted his move, because what was happening is things had already moved out of the enforcement model, and they started doing case management, all that stuff, and it was very effective. So I think it was very empowering for the workers themselves to be part of something that was so positive and successful. And when Larry O'Brien came in and said, you know, basically wanted everybody behind him to start kicking ass again, they resisted him, and really well. Like the one of the first things he did was when he got in, he canceled the crack pipe program, which was only a $8,000 a year program, but it was very effective in reducing health risks and also to help establish contact with people that have serious addictions. You know, the people passing them out could also start to develop rapport with them and help them get into treatment programs, stuff like that. So it was always considered to be a very inexpensive, effective program. So he comes in, smashes the whole thing, and he put out a a press release that he said if the community centers complain about him having done that, he's going to see reductions in their funding. And they all came out and condemned him anyway. And as well, the chief physician for the city also publicly condemned him for doing that. So I was so proud of that. It just, I don't know, it encouraged me.
Well, you know, I love the joke, you know, tough on crime increases crime, tough on drugs, you know, increases drug use immensely. So can we please have a war on tough on jobs and tough on money?
And tough on jerks.
Yeah. No, that would make more jerks.
That's true.
You know, yeah. I was up there, and as the listeners know, I spent a month on my sailboat this summer, and one of the places I ended up is sailing through Ottawa and taking the Rideau Canal, and I spent probably 3-4 hours at the base of the Parliament buildings waiting for the locks, so I'm sitting there floating around, and there was nowhere to tie up, so I was going around and around in circles, and I would go by, and then I'd go by Teresa Spence's teepee, and that was awesome, and then I'd go through the magnitude and the elegance of the Parliament buildings, and then I went by the homeless encampment, and with the tarps and the homeless encampment, and then I'd do the circle over and over again. And the irony of that statement to me was breathtaking. Here in the shadow of our Canadian Parliament is one of the largest homeless encampments that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So back on topic.
Yes.
I think something to keep in mind with this whole thing, and I mean, you mentioned how the mayor of Ottawa, or I guess, is he still the mayor? Or
no, we have a more humane mayor now.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
But I guess, yeah, he was saying something about, like, or I guess the approach in general with the homeless topic is the homeless are the problem, rather than looking at what causes homelessness. And I think something to keep in mind, especially with something like Bill 88, is that it's part of like a broader austerity agenda, right? Of kind of withering away those social services and any support system that a person can fall back on if needed. And you know, for the benefit of the powerful in this country. And I mean, yeah, like I said, this is just another way of doing that. And it's done in a very sneaky, way where people kind of overlook it, right?
Yeah.
Well, where we end up is, you know, if these kids don't get services, where do they go?
Yeah.
Well, this is it. This is what my big concern is, because as I say over and over again, except for a very short period in around when I'm talking about with the homeless, 16 and 17 year olds were being told ridiculous barriers to get on, regardless if they were from Children's Aid or not at that time. That's been corrected. And prior to that, it was always okay. Like, I myself left home at 16, and I'm 60. And I had, you know, that initial difficulty to get on, but I did get on because my parents were saying I could go back home, but it was an abusive home, and they ended up letting me on. And there wasn't any other services at the time, but that was just enough to keep me off the street and to, you know, to launch me, I guess. It's more, you know, more, everything's more slow and more difficult when you don't have that support backing, but I have a university degree, and no, I've been okay. Now, mind you, I'm not saying that that's all everybody needs, because oftentimes there's other unmet needs that need to be addressed also to provide the stability. So not just the income, right?
Exactly.
It'd be the income.
Absolutely.
I mean, on the flip side, I was out of home at 16 and I didn't have any support or services, and I grew up couch surfing and living in the park and starving to death. So,
oh my God.
So, you know, on the flip side, you know, and those are some of the absolute worst times of my life, where survival, everything came into play. And, you know, so I was the youth that was just trying to survive. And
yeah.
And by any means possible. And, you know, that's where kids get into the trouble with the law. That's where kids get in trouble with coping mechanisms. That's where these kids become, go to jail.
Exploited.
and youth programs that are in jails, and they're not fun. They're not good, and they're not healthy.
Yeah, I agree. And they're exploited too. They're very vulnerable.
Yeah,
that's a difficult issue too. And there's during the Harris days too, that son of a bitch also simultaneously brought in legislation prohibiting panhandling, and it was put forward as only for aggressive panhandling. But the way all the major cities enforced it was as though any panhandling was aggressive and therefore a violation. And they could even jail them. They were even jailing them because there was a provision in it that said if they did it several times, they could hold them in jail. They could give them a Part 3, summons, which has a court date on it, and keep them in jail until the court date so that they won't repeat. That was outrageous. And then there was another piece at the same time that they could pick anybody up off the street if they were considered to be unable to care for themselves, with a real loosey, you know, process involved. No appeals, no anything. So it's involuntary confinement without any due process. And they removed thousands, and this is so that the general public wouldn't know that he cut welfare in half in about 3 or 4 year period, and he didn't want us to see all these kids begging all over the street. He wanted to, you know, intimidate them into less conspicuous existence.
Well, jails are less conspicuous, mental health hospitals are less conspicuous, hospitals are less conspicuous, but they are very, very expensive.
And ineffective.
Totally ineffective, but very, very expensive.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's $600 a month to give a kid, you know, rent for $400 and then $225 for food, you know, that's a lot cheaper than jail.
Jail is $300 a day, provincial jail.
Yep, and hospital emergency rooms are $50,000 a first visit.
Yeah.
Mental health hospitals, I forget what the number is, but what is it, like 8,000 a month to put someone in?
Gotcha.
You know? Yeah. And how do these people think this is a great economic plan?
And in addition to that, is these things are all being privatized too, so that's a whole other issue in itself. And it's just a big mess.
I know.
So right now there's no oversight with CAS.
No.
So if you have a complaint with Children's Aid, what is your recourse?
I don't really have any, because like I said, the court cannot order the resources. You can't speak to the press and put pressure on them that way. You can protest sort of in a general way. You know, like, we don't like what they're doing, which doesn't really do much, right? Because in order to really expose something, you have to be specific, and you have to give evidence.
Okay,
so you have to produce a person.
Let's talk about a couple of these things here. You talked already about judges can't order against the Children's Aid. Why can't the press get involved?
Because of Section 45-8. In the Child and Family Services Act, it makes it an indictable offense to reveal any information that would identify a child. So they don't say if the press identifies the child. They make it more loose so that they could actually, any case that's reported, they could at least put them through the ringer. You know what I mean? Because You have to say something about the case, and they could say, oh, well, we believe that what you've said is information that could identify that child. Not that does, that could.
Well, the Children's Aid Society is very much on what could. They're not.
Yeah.
They don't base much on what is actually happening. They base on threat and risk and and things like that. So you can't go to the courts. You can't go to the press. You and I, those are our two main advocacy methodologies when when we want to systemically change something.
Yeah.
So.
I also rattle the politicians' chains too, right? Outside of the Children's Aid process. But within the Children's Aid process, that has no effect whatsoever. There's a link up on our website that we put up about Bill 88, and it's recent. A fellow had some difficulties with Children's Aid, and he wrote to his MPP, and his MPP wrote back, excuse me, we have no authority to intervene. So it's really clear if people want to see it. It's just such two letters, like a short letter to the MPP and a very short letter back. And there's a link on our news page.
And what's your website?
It's contactyourmpp.com.
Wonderful. Okay, so you can't use any of these advocacy methods that you and I use every single day. So you've gone in and the Children's Aid has told you that you're 16 years old, you're starving to death, you need assistance, and they have told you that we don't cover people with blonde hair, I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to go away. There's no recourse.
Absolutely not. What I saw happening is for whatever reason, certain kids were not getting, they were getting put out at 16, and they were being told they weren't meeting the expectations for education. But meanwhile, these kids were very, very damaged from abuse before going in the system and abuse in the system, in the CAS system. One child, and this is an absolute true story. One of the children that I met on the street, 16, was in Children's Aid because him and his sister witnessed his mother being raped and killed. He got no therapy, and he had, you know, obviously difficulty because of the trauma. And at 16, they told him, you know, you're not footing the bill here or whatever, and they booted him out on the street. And when I met him, he had some kind of an infection and no health card, and no drug card, no money, no anything. And I helped him with that. But I mean, like it's haphazard. Like I can't help everybody. I don't have enough resources, and I'm not an advantage point. I don't even know where everybody is that's in these kinds of situations.
So but, under the current system, without Bill 88, a 16-year-old goes in and gets turned down because their parents said they can live at home, but but it's an unsafe environment, and they get declined.
Mm-hmm.
We have we have all kinds of ways that we can advocate.
Yeah.
I just did one of these.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I put it in for reconsideration. I got the city councilor involved.
Yeah.
You know, we put political pressure on, and and we have the ability of filing legal lawsuits to make the situation better if we need to.
Mm-hmm.
And the child that I was working with is now covered.
Yeah, absolutely. I find it relatively easy. You know, sometimes it takes some shoe leather, like you're saying. You know, and other times it's just a matter of, you know, just recontacting OW or going with them, like going back and going with them. I've done that many, many times, and it gets reversed. Like I said, there was just that one short period of time where Harris government was going crazy there. But in Ottawa, they just completely reversed their acting position or whatever on that situation.
In and all of the years that I've been advocating and agitating, I have many times gone head to head with Children's Aid where I feel they're violating someone's human rights. They're violating the law. They're not acting in an appropriate and equitable manner. And I have not once won one of those cases.
Yeah. I have won some cases only at the beginning, where they're responding for the first time to the call. And I have sort of a technique that I use for that. But the case that I've been working on for the last couple of years was a situation. Any ones that are already advanced, I can't. I agree with you. Like, I've never been able to get any headway. Like, once they've actually removed the child, you know what I mean? Like,
yep.
And started the, nothing. I have nothing. And this one case was, she was 19 when she had the child, and they just came in the hospital, scoop, for no reason, and they were going on the premise of, that she was young, and she had been in Children's Aid. And their act, Child and Family Services Act, gives them the right to do that, to apprehend a child based on risk. And they're claiming that because she's young, her child's at risk, and because she was in the Children's Aid herself, that her child's at risk. And nobody has to take my interpretation of this, because you can read this in a pamphlet that's put out by, what is it called? Family Law Education for Women, FLU. And you can just Google that. And the pamphlet's called Child Protection, and it's on their website. On page 7, it says Children's Aid. And by the way, this pamphlet is paid for by the Ontario government and is distributed by the Family Court Clinic at the courthouses. Okay, so this is your government talking to you. And it says on page 7, Children's Aid may apprehend a child if they have serious concerns about the safety for the child. And they make a list of things. And the first one is if you've ever had a child or children removed before, and then a few others, drug addiction, homelessness, whatever. Then at the end, it says, or if you're a teen mother, especially if you were ever in the Children's Aid yourself. And they don't even have any, you know, shyness about it. It's just like right there in your face. Like, they're our territory. This young girl was told by the social worker at the hospital that half an hour after the baby was born, it was in her arms, and the social worker turns around and says, that's a CAS baby.
Oh, my God.
Sure enough, they came in scoop. And I witnessed that apprehension, and it was hideous.
That's terrible.
Well, you know, and Children's Aid actually doesn't teach any life skills to their crown wards, so how are they?
Yes, exactly. And I said at the time of the apprehension that she has a right to talk to a lawyer, you know, about what's going on, and they, like, completely mocked me about, like, as if, you know, what are you talking about? And they put that in their affidavit, you know, more or less, you know, misguided woman doesn't know that she does not have a right to a lawyer when they're apprehending her damn child.
You know, I really despise it when I end up in CAS affidavits.
Yeah. I got one classic one for you. In this application for this case, it says in one of the paragraphs, the society, doesn't say who or when, the society received a phone call from a community worker who wishes to remain anonymous that advises the society that a member of the community called them and told them that the mother's bathtub in her house was full of dishes and she was unable to take a bath, which on top of everything else is not true either. There was no one in her house. She had a small bachelor that she lived with someone else, and no one was, they weren't prohibited, but it just never occurred. There was nobody in her house visiting or anything else while she was pregnant.
And
she was a clean girl, too, on top of it. So she was my roommate for over 2 years. So it's totally not true. But even if it is true, okay, how are you going to defend yourself against the society received a phone call from an anonymous who had another call from another anonymous, and no specifics, not even when. Not on, June 2nd, whatever, so you could say, hey, I wasn't even in town on June 2nd. You can't say a damn thing. How can you defend yourself about that?
And these and are the people that want to take over welfare for 16 and 17 years olds, which is the point. And you may, I think everybody is in agreement that we need a child protection service. I don't think that's in contention in any way, shape, or form. But what we are saying is that the current system can't take care of the crown wards that they have. Why would we add a new privatization of a system that is working and move it to a system that is not working?
Exactly. That's my sentiment, 100%.
So to sum that up, well, Jane Scarf, it has been absolutely wonderful having you on the phone here. Please, people, talk to your MPPs about this. Do your own advocacy around that. And the website there for more information is www.contactyourmpp.com. This has
We'll fax a letter to their MPP for them if they'd like, or they can just cut and paste ours if they want to fax it themselves.
Wonderful. Awesome. So this has been Between the Margins. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Bailey Lamont.
And if you want to listen to more of our shows on other topics, you can see all of our blogs and all of our other things on the web at www.betweenthemargins.ca. And I hope you have your happily ever after, whatever that means to you.